where we stopped, right? We had went through a long song and dance. We had some hard process to find where everybody is. There's no photons involved for which their energies are softer than lambda, capital lambda. So this is a hard process. And then you added all the soft photons, and the ones, so soft photons could be anywhere, including in the interior, but the argument was that the ones that were diverging in the infrared were the ones where the soft photons connected the external lines. We had the leading behavior for the divergence. We followed and it factored out in front as a overall factor F, which exponentiated into this thing involving signs depending on whether or not the photons involved were attached to initial or final states. Charges are the things they're attached to, their momenta, and then this integral, and that was the integral. So the next few steps are going to be, and it's mostly algebraic, so let me give you the roadmap before we get there, is we want to evaluate J, the integral, because we can explicitly evaluate it. So we can identify how it diverges as a function of lambda. You can see that it's going to diverge logarithmically, schematically, because there's four k's here, and there's four k's being integrated. But we'll explicitly identify what the coefficient is. And that's first thing. Second thing is there'll be a check on this whole calculation, because for the special case where we have soft photons connecting to initial and final lines, that's a calculation we've done already, right? Because that's a wave function normalization. So there's something which should bother you about that, because I told you that the only time you get an infrared divergence is when you connect in an S matrix element. You connect external lines by a soft photon, but it was important that these external lines be on shell. But when we did the whole story of normalization, that was done in terms of, you know, the wave function normalization. In principle, the normalization that went on here was done with the external lines not necessarily on shell. It depended on how you chose your normalization scheme. So it might surprise you that there's, when these are soft, that there's an infrared divergence there. And that depends, so the statement there is that if you define, which we'll talk about when we get there, but if you define, you know, the renormalized self-energy involves subtractions. You're subtracting off the divergent parts of these things. And the statement that you only get infrared divergences when things are on shell is something which, the exception to that is, if you start subtracting things that are evaluated on shell, if your renormalization condition is defined on the mass shell for these external particles, then the renormalization constants can also be infrared divergent. And so by looking at how this diverges, once you've done the subtraction that defines the self-energy, the renormalized self-energy, you'll see that that gives us a check on the whole calculation, because the specific case where we're always connecting to the same line, which we can identify here by taking the eta's to be equal, what we can do is we can compare that to the wave function normalization and how it diverges, and you'll see that you get the same answer. So that's a consistency check, and it also tells you something about renormalizing can introduce infrared divergences, because the subtractions involved can make your integrand more infrared divergence. When you subtract off something with the goal of making the large K behavior more convergent, then the thing you're adding has got more K's in the denominator. So it's typically something which is more infrared divergent, even though it's less ultraviolet divergent. And so after you've subtracted, you can pick up infrared divergences there. But it all hangs together. And then the third thing will be, we'll do the process of emitting photons and then show how that combines with this to give you something which is finite. And while they all shoot each other out here, let's close the door. So that's where we're going. So it's not conceptually particularly complicated, but it's most of it, a good part of it is the evaluation of these integrals. So before evaluating the integral, the first thing to notice is that this integral is Lorentz invariant, right? Because this is Lorentz invariant, and then these things are all Lorentz invariant. So we're going to use that later on, because when we actually get the integral, we're going to get it as an integral over, you know, directions of the three momenta that are in K, say, because that's the thing we're integrating over. And because it's a Lorentz invariant integral, we'll be allowed to evaluate that in any frame we want. And so we'll choose the easy frame, and then that'll be what allows us to do the integral. All right. So the first step will be, we'll do the K0 part. You know, this D4K has got a spatial part and an energy part. And we'll do the energy part by residues, because that's what these epsilons are for. They're telling us how to do the energy part of the K integral and stay away from the poles. And the new thing is, normally this thing tells you to take the Feynman boundary condition, but then these things are also giving us now contributions to the K integral, which we'll have to be careful about. So what we want to do is we want to do that by residues. And so we want to keep track of where the poles are. So the poles of the integral of the integrand in the K0 plane. So there's two poles here, right? Because you know, K squared minus I epsilon is that's K squared minus K0 squared minus I epsilon. And so that's, you know, the absolute value of K minus K0. Okay, so we have four kinds of poles. There's a pole at K0 is equal to the absolute value of K minus I epsilon. There's a pole where K0 is equal to minus the absolute value of K plus I epsilon. So that's, you know, this one, that one. Then there's the poles that are here and here. So there's a pole at K0 is equal to what I'm going to do is I'm going to write. So we're using the condition. The pole is that is happens when Pn dot k minus I eta n epsilon say is equal to zero. So if I write this out, this is, you know, minus Pn zero k zero plus Pn dot k minus I eta n epsilon is equal to zero. And what we'll do is we'll pull out an overall factor of the energy of the external line here. So we'll have, call that minus, let's write that as En. That is, I'll take that as a common factor. So we'll have a minus K0 plus Pn over En dot K minus I eta n. And E is positive, so I'll just redefine what I mean by epsilon and not write it again, equals zero. And this ratio, momentum divided by energy, you know, that's what you mean by the velocity, right? So that would be the three velocity of this particular particle. So the pole here will be at Vn dot k minus I eta n epsilon. And the other one will be the same thing for Vm plus. And again, I did the same thing I think I did the other day. I forgot to write this sign here. Remember, there was a sign there because the momentum was flowing out of one of these lines. It was flowing into one of the lines, and we derived this factor assuming momentum was flowing out. And so where it's flowing in again, we had to have a minus sign there. So I should have written that there. And I remember I caught myself and checked and corrected that last class. I just forgot to write it again. So we've got Vm. And I guess I want to make sure I label the Vs now, the Ms and the Ns properly. So I've done it, yeah, M is the guy with the minus sign. So then we have Vm dot K plus I eta M epsilon. So we're interested in particular, you know, doing this integral in the K0 plane. and we're doing the integral from minus infinity to infinity. And we're going to want to close the contour either on the top or the bottom. And we'll do that where it's convenient, and that'll be dictated by where these poles are, right? So so these first two are always, so this one is at a positive value of k-naught, which is slightly negative imaginary part. So this is the ith kind of a pole. And this one is at negative values of k with a positive imaginary part. So this is pole number two. And these guys will depend on the sine of eta. So they're going to be at some, and this will be some dot product, which will be positive or negative. But the imaginary part, which is what counts for closing the contour, is going to be controlled by the sine of the eta here. So let's do the various cases. We'll do the cases where these things are the same, and then we'll do the cases where they're opposite, and then we'll do the cases where they're the same later on. So case one. Let's take eta n equals plus 1 and eta m equals minus 1. So in that case, if eta n is plus 1, then k0 has got a small negative imaginary part. So somewhere down here, and where it is in the bottom here, it doesn't make a difference really, but in that case, pole number 3 would be down here. And in this case, because eta m is negative, then this is also down here somewhere. So the convenient direction in which to close the contour is, in that case, this way, because there's only one pole to think about, although it doesn't make a difference which way you do it. So what we'll do is we'll pick off the residue at this particular pole, in this case, case one. So we just have to read off the, you know, so we're looking at the k, it's this particular residue that we're trying to follow. And so so in that case, we have 1 over, you know, k squared minus I epsilon is approximately, I use that expression there. It's 1 over the value of k minus k naught. And if I put define this, the new epsilon where I pulled out a factor of k naught, I can put it inside the bracket here. So that'll be 1 over 2 times epsilon pi of k, 1 over thank you, that's great. Okay. Thank you. All right, so we can pick off the residue. We're looking for this residue here. And what J becomes in that case is, this is JNM. Make sure I'm defining this the same way. In my notes, I call this NM. It's not necessarily symmetric because of that sign. So let me make sure I'm always consistent in the way I write this. NM. All right, so we have the... there's the overall minus I that was in the definition, and there's the 2 pi to the fourth that was in the definition. We're going to get the 2 pi I from the residue theorem, and it's positive because we're going counterclockwise. We've got the integral over the modulus of k, the 3 momentum k. So it goes from lambda to capital lambda dk. Then we have the residue here, 1 over 2k. Actually, let me write this. Let me do the, not split the modulus yet from the angles. We got 1 over pn dot k plus en times the absolute value of k. And the other factor becomes pm dot k plus em times the absolute value of k. So all we've done is the 2K was the residue because we picked off that pole. And then these guys got evaluated at the pole. And so that that told us what K0 was. And that allows us to write it in this particular way. And we don't need the I epsilons anymore because if I scale out K and E, you know, I've got En times the absolute value of K here. And then this is multiplying, in that case, Vn dot the unit vector for K. Let's write that as, say, E sub K plus 1. And this dot product is going to be, for any mass of particle, the speed is less than 1, right? Because it's going less than the speed of light. So this dot product is always less than, is between minus 1 and plus 1. It's strictly less than 1 and strictly bigger than minus 1. And so this, you're not passing through 0 in these denominators, so you don't have to worry about the epsilons there anymore. But in this case, it's polynomials. The dangerous thing, you're forced into a choice if you have an integrand which is kind of, you know, an exponential or something where it's blowing up at one end and it's not blowing up the other end. But for these polynomials, typically things are clean at both ends because things are falling off, like the absolute value of the power of the thing that you're looking at. So what'll happen is that if there's one of the choices we're going to make, three of the poles will be at the top here, so then we'll close it at the bottom, and it'll be easier to do. But if you did either side, it'd give you the same answer because the arc infinity is always giving you zero. I said polynomials, but I mean, you know, rational functions of powers. Okay, so that's the integral we're trying to do now, the three-dimensional integral. And so the modulus part of it is simple because the absolute value of K comes out of here and comes out of here, and that gives us the divergent part. So the you know, the integral of the modulus of K from lambda to lambda, we're getting what we expected to get now. We got one factor, two factors, and four factors of K. So we have dk. So the d3k, I'm going to use that, you know, d3k is k squared dk, you know, times the direction integral for k. And so let's focus on this. So we have k squared dk over k to the fourth. And I've got something wrong there. What did I do wrong there? Because it's not k to the fourth, it's k cubed. And so that'll be the thing that's just dk over k. So that's just our factor of log of lambda over lambda. And the coefficient will be the angular integral. So what we want here is we've got j, n, m will be, so we've got minus, the I goes with the I and gives you 1. So we've got 1 over 2 pi cubed times logarithm of lambda over lambda. 2 will come out, I guess. And then we have the integral d2 omega k of 1 over, I guess we can pull out the factors of en and em. And then we've got the integral over the velocities here, right? So we got the vn dot ek plus 1 times, I'll write the over minus sign. We have vm dot ek plus 1. Get that right? Yes. So let me call this integral imn. Because what we're going to find is when we choose, you know, this we're learning that j is equal to I. In this case, that these zetas were chosen in this particular way, when we choose to make different choices for the zetas, we're going to find that j is different from I. So that's why I'm kind of giving this a separate name. And this integral, we know, has to be Lorentz invariant because j was Lorentz invariant. And so that means that we're free to evaluate this in our favorite frame. And let's make the favorite frame the one where one of these things is at rest. So since INM or MN is Lorentz invariant. And that's true since J was. Can evaluate in any frame. What we'll do is we'll choose the frame where, say, V sub n is equal to 0. because we know that these guys are time-like particles. There exists a frame where they have a rest frame. So in that frame, then Mn becomes, you know, so there's these factors, minus 1 over 2 pi cubed, logarithm. Then we have the, sorry? No, I wasn't switching them. Thank you. Wasn't meaning to switch them. What I had was NM, right? So. It's too bad. The one I use in my notes is the counterintuitive one that I would not normally, I normally write it in alphabetical order, but. It's gonna, you're gonna see it when J differs from I, there'll be an anisometric current.
So it's just a special case of betas, which makes this anisometric.
I think so, yeah. right, so we have, now the integral, the angular integral is gonna be, there's an integral over, if I use polar coordinates now. So what we'll do is we'll use the rest frame for V, and let's choose K to point in the Z direction, because we were allowed to, it's rotationally invariant. Let's choose E sub K along the Z axis. And then we'll just use polar coordinates. So this dot product is basically just the speed times the cosine of the angle, the polar angle, theta. So we'll have an integral from 0 to 2 pi d phi, an integral from 0 to pi of sine theta d theta is what this volume element was. In this rest frame, we've got 1 over the mass of n, because it's in its rest frame, but then we have the energy of m, because it's not in its rest frame. Vn is 0, so this is just 1, and we have this factor of 1 over vm cosine theta plus 1. Strictly speaking, you're right. Yeah, no, you're right. That so I'm lying to you a little bit here, but the so if we really wanted, so if the goal was to calculate the finite part as well, then you'd have to really be careful about how you define things. Well, the reason I'm going to get away with it being Lorentz invariant is I'm only picking off the coefficient of the divergent part. And because of that, that's why I'm getting something which is Lorentz invariant in front of it. But you're right, that's a good point that the cutoff, if I really define this in terms of a cutoff, which is what I'm ultimately doing when I do the integral over K, that's breaking the Lorentz invariant. Okay.
Yeah,
you're right. Thank you. All right, well, I think I'm still good. Let me just make sure that I haven't lied to you yet. What's that? It's the mass of the nth particle. It, you know, it's because it's in the rest frame, the energy is the mass, so it's the rest frame. All right. So in my notes, I actually did this. Let me just press on and finish the integral here, which is not the way I did my notes, so I run the risk of doing something stupid. So the integral is pretty easy to do because this is just, you know, this is just basically d cosine theta. So you've got something which is going to be a logarithm because you've got a 1 over, you know, if I scale, I've got 1 over something linear in the thing I'm integrating, and then nothing depends on phi, so I'll get a factor of 2 pi from that. So the so let me just give you the answer. So I n m will be In my notes, I did it a little bit differently. So there's a factor of 2 pi to the fourth less than what I had here. So we have minus 2 pi squared divided by 2 pi to the fourth. One of these 2 pi's I've done already, so we got minus pi over 2 pi cubed times 1 over the mass of n times the energy of m times the log of lambda over lambda. And then the cosine, the integral over cosine theta gives us the logarithm because it's a 1 over linear thing. The logarithm is 1 plus b sub m over 1 minus b sub m. Right, because it's coming to you as we have an integral basically dx of 1 over from minus 1 to 1 of vm x plus 1 is where that log is coming from. So did I get that right? Sine is right. The thing that's funny is the 2. So I think that I'm suspicious about this 2 because at some point I don't have it here. Minus I so I've got, I guess here is where I wrote it down. So I've got minus actually why did the sign came from over there, right? Minus the log multiply this thing by 2 pi to the fourth, I would have had pi. So the 2 actually is right here. Oh, I'm going to be missing a factor of v. To do this integral, let me do this integral more carefully. That's probably what I'm doing, getting the 2s wrong. So the integral of phi gives a factor of 2 pi. That just made that into a 2 pi. So let me put that up top and just fill in the steps because I think I'm just doing a stupid thing here. So we have 1 over 2 pi cubed, and we have 2 pi from doing the phi integral. And then we have an integral minus 1 to 1 dx of 1 over vx plus 1. So if we multiply and divide by v, then we can call this u. And this is u, and the limits are minus v to v. And so then the integral is just log of 1 plus v over 1 minus v. And so the pi's, the way they played out was we had 1 over 2 pi squared, right? Which is actually, that agrees with what we had there. So the 2's are good. Okay, so I've, the But what I missed here was the factor of V. So there's a factor of Vm, which is that factor of V that I got by the change of variables. Okay, so the claim was that this was Lorentz invariant, so, but it's written in a very, what looks like a non-Lorentz invariant way, but we can rewrite it in a Lorentz invariant way by taking, you know, what we have to do is express these, you know, the E's and the M's and the velocities in a way which is more manifestly Lorentz invariant. So the simple one is V, you know, the V in the general case, what Vm will be, so in a general frame, Vm would be the relative velocity. I'll call it Bmn, relative speed. The relative speed of two particles is a Lorentz invariant thing, right? Because everybody agrees what it is. No matter what your moving motion is, the relative velocity is what the velocity of one of them is in the rest frame of the other one. It doesn't matter which one you choose, but everybody agrees on that. So there should be a way of writing the relative velocity, which is what this would be. This is the velocity of one in the rest frame of the other, in a Lorentz invariant way. And the way to do that is to take a manifest. If we take a manifestly Lorentz invariant thing, the dot product of the two four momenta, then if we evaluate that in the rest frame of one of the particles, that would have been the mass of the one times the mass of the other divided by the. I mean, in the rest frame of the particle of one of these particles, this is basically the product of the energies. But that's equal to their masses. In the rest frame of let's say particle n, the energy is just equal to E sub n. But the energy of the other guy is its mass divided by the square root of 1 minus whatever the velocity was squared, or, you know, of this particle in the rest frame of that particle, which is what we mean by the relative velocity. So the way to solve for. So we were looking for a Lorentz invariant, manifestly Lorentz invariant way of writing the relative velocity, and this is it. We solve this for beta, and that'll give us beta in terms of the masses, the rest masses, which are invariant, and an explicitly Lorentz invariant dot product. So if we solve for beta mn, and what we find is that beta mn, I won't do the algebra because I can't do algebra in real time, but beta is the square root of 1 minus mn squared over pn dot pm squared. So that would be in an arbitrary frame, how you'd figure out the relative velocity. So this product here, the way to think of it probably, the simplest way to think about it is what? So we've dealt with this, we've dealt with this. We haven't dealt with this, and the thing is, we know we can deal with it because in this rest frame, the energy of m is given by what I wrote here. It's the mass divided by something involving the relative velocity, which we know is covariant. And I just want to write it in a simpler form. So what we'll do is we'll, the product that we have, mn times em times beta, or the velocity m, we can write that as being mn mm over the square root of 1 minus bm squared times the velocity, or the speed m. And so if we just use this definition again, this thing we know is equal to that. You know, this product, a better way to write this, a simpler way to write this would have been to write this as being mn em, or the product of the energies in this frame, times vm, because this we know is equal to that. And this we know is equal to that. So that's minus pn dot pm. So this is in the rest frame. We're looking for a Lorentz invariant thing which agrees with this, because we calculate a Lorentz invariant thing which is equal to this, or involves that, in the rest frame. So in the rest frame, this factor is this, and then velocity is that square root. And so you can see I can put the p inside the square root, and this whole thing is really the square root of pn dot pm squared minus the masses. So it's up to you how you write it. The way I'm going to write it is INM in a general frame is going to be, so we have this product of energies is minus Pn dot Pn. So the overall minus sign I'm going to lose. And we're going to get 1 over pi over 2 pi cubed is 1 over 8 pi squared times 1 over Pn dot Pm. That's Lorentz invariant. That's the energy factor. We've got our logarithm of lambda over lambda. And then we've got something involving beta, which I'll just leave explicitly as a function of beta. So we have 1 over beta Nm log of 1 plus beta Nm 1 minus beta Nm. This factor here, if in the non-relativistic limit, beta goes to 0, you know, what's happening here is that this log is going to 1, log of 1, so that's going to 0. So if you Taylor expand to linear order in beta, the betas will cancel. So although this looks like it might be singular when beta goes to 0, it's not. So as beta mn goes to 0, you know, this 1 over beta log of 1 plus beta over 1 minus beta goes to 2. But when beta goes to 1, if you had relativistic particles, if one of the electrons had been massless, then you're dead meat because this is doing something finite, but this thing in the logarithm is blowing up. So as beta nm goes to infinity, the same thing goes to, not infinity, goes to 1 from below, then what will happen is that this will go to infinity. All right. That was case 1. So you'll be happy to know that case 2 and 3 and 4 are basically all the same, or very similar. So let's leave this, and then let's do case 2. So the next simplest one is let's just have them be different. You know, the thing we were looking at here was because of, you know, in our graph, what did this choice mean? A to n being plus 1 meant it was in the initial state, I think. So we were looking, when we did this, we were looking at that contributions that were like this, where we were looking at radiative corrections which go from the beginning to the end. We're focusing on one particular pair here when we do that, because this only has two indices, n and m. So what we'll do now is we'll do the other case that's like that. If we take eta n equals minus 1 and eta m equals plus 1, so it's morally the same kind of a graph. It's just that we're thinking of it going the other way. You're not going to be surprised we're going to find essentially the same answer, but we have to kind of track the poles first. So in this case, if we look in the k-naught plane, you know, we always have the first two poles are always the same. So the ones coming from the k squared, that's just the Feynman propagator. But now what happens is that we just basically flip these guys both to the other side. So we'll have pole 3 will be up here somewhere, and pole 4 will be up here somewhere. So in this case, what we'll do is we'll close the contour down below. But we only have to keep, again, I labeled them differently. This is pole 1, and that's pole 2. So instead of keeping this guy, we're just going to keep this guy as all. All right, so then what we'll have in that case is, so we have the minus I over 2 pi to the fourth that went along for the ride. We have the 2 pi I from the contour integration, but now it's negative 2 pi I because we went clockwise. We have the residues, which are basically the same, but where they're now the residue is at, instead of k was minus k, it's k is equal to plus k, so we're picking off this factor here, but that doesn't change this, so we'll have our 1 over integral d3k, we'll we'll have 1 over 2 the opposite pi of k. And then our momenta here will be as they were before. I guess the way I wanted to write that, I guess I left it like it was. So I have 1 over and then we have minus 1 over so the only difference really is the flipping of this sign here, these signs, the minuses. But that's really not a difference. Because what we're going to do is we're going to integrate over all the directions of k. And so in particular, for every particular value for k, there's a piece in the integral for which k is minus k. And if you take k to minus k, the absolute value doesn't change, but this term does change. And so if you took k to minus k, this integral would become this integral. So if we do a change of variables here, k goes to minus k, we might as well have had a plus sign there. So after k goes to minus k in the integrand. Doesn't matter anyway, yeah. So the bottom line is that this was j, and we see that it's going to be again the same answer, I n n n. So we don't have to calculate it again. So we can do case 3. So let's choose the 8 is the same sign. Let's make them both positive.
When you take the negative k, is anything happening with the boundary?
No, because these are limits on the modulus of k. And the thing that took k to minus k is the angles change, right? So that doesn't change. So this pictorially is the case where we're taking two of these guys to be on the same side, say. So you might expect that to be different. In particular, you're going to see that the difference between, we're going to get this again. There's a piece which is universal to all the cases, but there's a piece that you only see when the photon connects two lines that are both in the initial state or the final state. And that piece is a pure phase, and it's telling you about the Coulomb interaction between those two particles. So we're going to get something different, but it's the physical case where the photon is on one side or the other is, you know, the new thing is the Coulomb interaction phase. So what we have to do is just evaluate everything. So we have to follow our poles. So we still have, I guess that's 2 and this is 1. And then the only thing now is that we have, if they're both positive, then 3 is still below the axis, but now 4 is above the axis. And you know they're just infinitesimally above, so we can, you know, there's no big profit to close one way or the other, so I'll close at the top. So if we close on the top, then we have our factor of minus I over 2 pi to the fourth is there. We're closing counterclockwise, so we get a factor of 2 pi I. You know, the residue from the k factor doesn't change. It's just one of the others, so we're going to get our 1 over 2k. And then we just have to contract the velocities. And so let me tell you the answer rather than doing it in real time. So we're going to get I'm partly lying to you here. Yeah, no, sorry. The difference is when I said, I was too fast when I said that this didn't change. This doesn't change. You know, there's two residues. There's one from here and one from here. So the one from here won't change because that's still at k naught equals k. And so you just pick off this. But the residue here is not at k0 equals the absolute value of k, the three-measure. It's at the it's at k0 is equal to something involving the dot product of v with k. So that'll change. When I evaluate this at that residue, that'll change what we get. So let me just write it. So probably the simplest way to write it is to write it this way. Is to say that, so it's, actually, I'll write one step here. Integral d3k, the residue at 2 plus the residue at 4. The residue at 2 is exactly what we did before. Right, that was in case one, all we had was the residue at 2. So this is just going to give us our INM again. So what we want to do now is focus on the residue at 4, because that's the new piece. So let's call that plus I prime NM, and let's evaluate what I prime is. So I prime NM will be minus I over 2 pi to the fourth. 2 pi I integral d3k, and I won't try and do it in real time. I'll just tell you what the residues are. There's 1 over em times 1 over k squared minus vm dot k squared. There's 1 over pn dot k minus en dm dot k. So this is the 1 over k squared term evaluated at the residue 4. That's where that came from. That's the energy. And then this is the residue of the, this is the guy that is not, this is the thing that would be pole number 3. Evaluated at the residue, at the position of the residue of the pole number 4, and this is just the residue of the pole number 4. So again, we can do the integral, and it's easier to do than the other one was. So. Same Lorentz invariant argument. We know that this is Lorentz invariant, that's Lorentz invariant, so that's Lorentz invariant if we're just picking off the logarithm. And so you can pull the modulus of k out and then do the angular integral. So let me do that right. So let's do that. So we have... So we're going to get so the minus I takes out the I. One of the two pi's goes. So we get 1 over 2 pi cubed times 1 over enem logarithm of lambda. And our angular integral is... Integral 0 to 2 pi d phi, integral from 0 to pi of d cos theta, minus 1 to 1 d cosine theta of 1 over 1 minus vm squared cosine the squared theta, 1 over... Let me pull this a sign here. I'll pull out an overall minus sign. I'll have Vm x cosine theta psi epsilon. So I've done the things I did before, gone to the frame where defines the z axis. So the 2 pi integral is going to be easy, and we just have to do this thing, and it's a little bit more complicated here. But what saves it, what makes this an easier integral to do in the end is that the, you know, there's a you got to be, the cosine theta is going through zero, and this is blowing up there. So the I epsilon is telling you how to handle that singularity. And so if, you know, if I write x as cosine theta, the important thing is that the rest of the integrand is even under cosine theta goes to minus cosine theta. So as epsilon goes to zero, you know, the way to think about this is we have 1 over x plus I epsilon. So if I write that as being, you know, x minus I epsilon over x squared plus epsilon squared, you can see that there's a piece which is odd under, the real part is odd under x goes to minus x. And then the imaginary part is even under x goes to minus x. If you take epsilon to zero, then if you replace 1 over x plus I epsilon and you follow the real part of the integral, this is the thing that would give you the principal part. That's what you would mean by the principal part of the integral over dx, 1 over x. And what this one does is epsilon goes to zero. If x is not zero, when epsilon goes to zero, that's zero. But if x is equal to zero, then this is 1 over epsilon, and as epsilon goes to zero, that's infinity. And if you integrate this against x, you'll see that it's a delta function. That's something which, if you take a function of x times this thing, integrate over x through any region that which is, includes x equals zero, you pick off the value of this function at f equals zero. And so this thing is a delta function, and the normalization comes from that exercise of integrating against a function. And I think it's pi as a normalization. Yes. Now, in our particular case, because the thing we're integrating is even under x goes to minus x, or cosine goes to minus cosine, this piece is going to drop out. And so all we have to follow is this piece. And the delta function makes it very easy to do the integral because we're just supposed to evaluate everything at x equals zero. So the bottom line is, I should leave that. Bottom line is that we have I in M prime will be minus 1 over 2 pi squared. And we have the minus I pi, so we'll have plus I pi. So let me put the pi's together here. We have minus I over 4 pi squared, 4 pi. There's something wrong with that. Two pi squared times pi psi over 4 pi. I guess that's right. What else we have? We have the 1 over enEm. Again, we didn't quite have x here. We had x times v. So what I would do is change variables from x to the product of x times v. But if I do that here, I have to divide by v. So I'll have vm. We'll have the our logarithm of lambda over lambda. And then we have the this thing evaluated at 0 will just be 1. And we're done. So is that the right answer? 4i pi cubed divided by 4. Yeah, actually, I over 4 pi. That's right. All right, so so that's the bottom line in case three, is that J is the old answer we had plus this. And the important thing is you remember that Ji, as we calculated, was real, and this is imaginary. This is And then if we do case four, it's pretty simple. Theta m is minus one. It's morally the same kind of situation where we're, instead of connecting the lines on the one side, on this side, we're now connecting them on this side. And the poles, what will happen is that these poles will jump. From here, these guys will both switch. So we're going to have a pole up and a pole down. And so we can close it the same way. And all that's going to happen is that basically n is going to be switched with m, because if we close on the same contour, instead of having the v dot, instead of, say, having this guy give us a pole, we're going to have this guy give us a pole. So what we'll get is J and M is I and M plus I prime M N. So I've changed the order here. And this factor here, I didn't write it. I should have written it in a covariant way. And we can write it in a covariant way as we did before. So we have the E with the E is minus the dot product of the four velocities, 1 over pn dot pm times the relative velocity, nm, times ln of lambda over lambda. And what bothers me is that that's symmetric under m goes to n, and I don't think it was. Let me just check that. No, because it's a speed. Oh no, that's right. So it is symmetric. So it's so it didn't make any difference how I wrote it. So basically, this answer is the same as the previous answer, the one case three. So the bottom line is that if a to n is not equal to a to m, then JNM is equal to INM. And if A to N equals A to M, so this is when they're, you're connecting things initial to final state. But if you're connecting things in the initial or final state, then JNM is INM plus I prime. Do you guys, would you rather have the fan on or the door closed? Fan on, okay. There's no escape. Anyone else got a card they can try and do this thing on? We should be able. What's that? There we go. So we're going to need a chair here. All right, so now we can pull everything together. Let's do that here. So and what we had, this factor F, was given by this thing, a bunch of things, but in particular, it multiplies the J by P dot P. And in every case, for I, there's a factor of the dot product of the two P's, right? There's the, somewhere here I wrote it in terms of the betas, I'm hoping. Yeah, so here's a factor of P dot P. And then for I prime, here's the factor of P dot P. So that's going to cancel out. So we have F is going to be the exponential. So in the case that we only have I, we have that factor. So we're going to have we have the 1 half, so we have 1 over 16 pi squared, some nm of, now these, I'm going to take the case where the eta's are opposite to start off with. So there's an overall minus sign from that, times qn, qm. Sorry, J is I, and I is that, and we've got rid of the dot products. We have the log. And then there'll be the terms where the sum is, they're equal. But J has a factor of I always, right? Because in the case when the eta's are equal, we have this. There's just an overall sign that would change. So maybe the way to say that is to write it separately. So we'll have plus 1 over 16 pi squared. And in this case, we also have the imaginary piece, which is this thing here. So we have minus I. There's a factor of 2 out front, so we've got a over 8 pi. Of did I get that sign right? Yeah, I think it's right. So you see that because these guys are real, we can write this as being the exponential is really lambda over lambda to a power, call that power A, and that power A will involve all this other stuff. And then there's a phase, which you can call e to the minus I g or something, where g is this stuff here. It's 1 over 8 pi. where the eta's are equal. And A, for completeness, let me write it out. It's going to be we have it here, it's plus 1 over 16 pi squared sum over nm n, eta m qn qm over beta nm times this logarithm. All right. Yeah, no, it is positive, and I'm just trying to see how you see that. It's looking to me like it's going to, you know, if you take a simple example, like if you took a hard scattering at just two states, so then, you know, N and M runs over, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so we're going to get whenever we do all three of the lines the same, so you know, the sum over nm is going to be sum over n, where they're the, you know, where we take them to be equal to each other, n equals m, and then there'll be a. Actually, in this case, we can just do it probably one by one. Let's take all the charges to be the same. We take a new board here. This now. So for for 2-to-2 scattering, 1, 2, 3, 4, and what would A be? A is going to be Q squared over 16 pi squared. And let's do it in the center of mass. So that the center of mass frame, you know, the relative velocity here will be something. And it'll be the same thing here. So it's elastic scattering. And then I guess from here to here, that'll be the, what'll it be? That'll depend on angles. So let's do the simple ones first. So we'll have, so this, all the time when we do the two photons here, two photons here, two, 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 that's the case where eta is always the same, so we're always getting something positive. So we're getting, in that case, and all the speeds are always the, I guess the relative speed when you do a self-energy on the same leg is zero. So we'll have four of those. So we'll have remember the limit of 1 over beta log 1 plus beta over 1 minus beta as beta goes to 0 goes to 2. So we'll have 4 times 2. And then we'll have the cases where we connect those two lines, where we'll have 2 over v log 1 plus v over 1 minus v, center mass. And then we're going to have these guys. We'll have that one, that one, that one, and that one. And there the wild card is going to be, there's a simple way to get the speed. Well, I could take whatever I like for the initial final state. Let's take the case where, you know, one and two come in, and then, you know, they just scatter backwards. Let's just say that this is three, and that's four, because in that case, the relative speed between one and three will be zero, and one and four will be v again. That'll be v. 2 and 4 will be 0, 2 and 3 would be v. So what we'd have in that case would be minus two cases where we get 0, and then we'll have minus two cases where we get 1 over v . So you can kind of see that those guys are canceling those guys, and these guys are adding up to give you something positive. So in this case, it's positive, but the general statement, and I don't know how to justify it, is that A is positive. I don't think it's ever negative for any choice of the kinematics. And so in that case, as you know, the absolute value of F would go to infinity as lambda goes to zero. That's one observation. Now, I've already made the observation that the phase here is the Coulomb phase. So there's a kind of a famous divergent scattering phase for two charges because of the long range of the Coulomb force, and that's what you're looking at there. Another point to notice is that if V were to go to zero, if beta nm ever goes to zero, then A also diverges, because this factor here is diverging. And that's a sign that, so for quantum electrodynamics, you don't care because there's no massless charged particles. But that's a sign that if you had massless charged particles, there'd be things to worry about. And so, so massless charged particles will change the story I'm telling you about everything, all the divergences canceling, and ruin the story. I haven't finished telling the story about the cancellation, but you can see here how a massless charged particle could be a problem. And in the gravity case, there is effectively a massless charged particle because the graviton itself is emitting gravitons. But in that case, the divergence you get here is compensated for by the momentum dependence that's in the coupling for the graviton. But in a Yang-Mills theory where you really have gluons emitting gluons, then you're more or less in this situation. And so it really is a more singular situation. And so this singularity is something which is solved by the KLN theorem, where you have to sum over initial and final states. But there really is the fact that things go sick on you when beta goes to zero is not an accident. And quantum electrodynamics would be very different if we had massless charged particles. And this is probably why we don't have them. All right. And blah, 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 blah. All right. So I don't know, given that the thing is almost over. Yeah? What's that? Yes, sorry. So I don't know, I was going to take you through the renormalization story, but maybe the thing to do is to, you can take yourself through the story. But the claim is that if I take the special case here where, maybe this is a good homework exercise, which is in the notes so you can follow along, but it's good to see it happen. Either it'll be at homework or I'll do it next class. But the claim is special case where, you know, n is equal to m. So you're correcting a particular line with a self-energy. Should agree with the wave function renormalization, the soft part of the wave function renormalization of the fields. So you remember, we know that the electron field, the renormalized electron field is some factor z, I think it was z2, minus 1/2 of the the bare field. And so this factor we can calculate in terms of the self-energy graph. And you remember it was defined by the self-energy graph, the self-energy function sigma star was defined so that if we took IP or P slash equals to IM, so we were on shell for the Dirac equation, then it was equal to zero. And then we asked for the residue. So that means if we Taylor expand in powers of P slash minus IM, we wanted the residue to be one. That was what defined Z. But this condition here where we're subtracting, so this says that the self-energy, after you do, you know, there's also a counterterm here, which is enforcing this condition. This plus this is effectively, you know, we have some integral, some integrand, some integral d4k of some function of k. And what the counterterm is doing is you know, it's a function of k and p, slash, let's say. And what the counterterm is doing is subtracting the same thing at p slash equals im. And although this is infrared finite, because there's nothing, nobody said anybody had to be on shell on the external lines, this difference can be IR divergent because of the subtraction. And so the claim is that if we calculate the infrared divergent part of this difference, which we can do the same way by following the small k limit and asking how it would diverge if k is very small, we can figure out how z diverges as the, you know, as little lambda goes to zero, as infrared cutoff goes to zero. And the claim is that what we will find in this, we know that the S matrix element is given by powers if we have a scattering process, there's going to be powers of the wave function renormalization for the external lines times some correlation function. And so the claim will be that these factors of Z that the LSZ reduction formalism say should be there, which diverge in the infrared because of the subtraction, are going to agree exactly. You know, they're explicitly factors in front of the amplitude. They're going to agree exactly with what we've calculated over here in the case that N is equal to M and beta is equal to zero, because that corresponds to the self-energy line. And so the exercise is to calculate this subtraction and evaluate it explicitly to watch it diverge and get the coefficient, because the comparison between these two calculations has to agree, including the factors of 2 and pi, and it does. And I'll either do that on Friday or I'll put it in an assignment, which I'm going to give you guys soon. So that's probably a good place to stop.